Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, sponsored by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome. This is Risky Business number 9 for Tuesday, April 17. We're in a bit of a silly mood today at itradio.com.au HQ. It could have something to do with all of the exciting news this week. Vulnerabilities everywhere, it's a bonanza. We'll be chatting to Carl Hanmore from Auscert shortly. He joined us on his awful cordless phone from home. He's actually quite crook, so thanks to Carl for plucking up the courage to get out of bed and face us here. We'll also check in with our sponsor Cybertrust to chat about the Windows DNS flaw that seems to be actively exploited out there. There's a bit of FUD around on that one, so we're hoping to clear it up and have a bit of a discussion around best practice. We'll also be chatting to Jason Edelstein from Sense of Security about Voice over IP and hearing from Voice over IP vendor Cisco on the same issue. That's our feature this week. But of course, it's time first to check in on this week's news with ZDNet Australia's Munir Kataria. Munir, it looks like Microsoft's fixed another zero-day glitch in Windows, also affecting Vista. They're not having much luck, are they?
No, there's been so many of these. And yeah, I mean, this is just another patch. This is the second lot of patches that they've already brought out this month.
Yeah. Well, it also appears that this is one of those issues that they initially said, hey, don't worry, it's a minor denial of service bug that might be able to be exploited if the planets are in alignment, that turned out to actually be quite serious. So
it wasn't just Microsoft that was saying that. I think it was some of the experts that didn't think it was a big deal either, but it seems to have turned out that way. I'm not sure it's because they just missed something at the time or they've found, you know, an extra way through because of the original bug, but yeah, it's definitely a serious issue now.
Well, when there's a will, there's a way. Now, we were just talking before we started the interview that perhaps every time there's a vulnerability disclosed in either a Microsoft or an Oracle product, we should drink, you know, turn it into a bit of a drinking game. So, you know,
I think if we did that, then the brewers would definitely want to be sponsoring your site too.
I was about to say, you know, given this next news item, it'd be a fast track to alcoholism because Oracle's just released a patch for 37 flaws.
Oh, that's great! That makes it 88 so far this year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, unbreakable my ass. I mean, I just have to say that's. You know, I mean, look, all software products have problems. All software products have vulnerabilities, but it really doesn't lend much weight to their claim that their product is unbreakable, does it?
Are they still saying that? I thought after they first started saying that, they kind of like driven away from it. But no, they're still claiming that, are they?
Yeah, no, I think the unbreakable campaigns are still an ongoing thing, but it really is quite appalling, isn't it?
It's incredible how you can keep saying that when, you know, it's so obvious that, no, there are definitely issues here. But, I mean, the scary part for me here, Patrick, is that Oracle is used in everything, you know, every major transaction, every credit card transaction, pretty much all of them eventually at some point go through an Oracle database.
Yeah, we discussed this at one point, didn't we? And it really is the repository for pretty much everything. I mean, your banking details. I mean, it's either going to be Oracle or SQL.
Yeah.
But Oracle is, you know, pretty big time. So you're right. At one point or another, pretty much every single bit of data associated with you is going to pass through an Oracle database.
And with this many vulnerabilities, I mean, 88 so far this year, God knows how many of them are actually been exploited, but you only need one or two to be exploited for there to be an awful lot of trouble. So
yeah, drink up. So, okay, we've got also some sort of comments from the Department of the Bleedingly Obvious from Commonwealth Bank.
I was going to say the same thing, yes. This is the Commonwealth Bank saying that cyber criminals are trying to use malware to attack their customers.
Yeah, well, I think what they're saying is, you know, now that they've sort of, to some extent, stitched up the phishing vector by going for a two-factor authentication solution, which is, you know, a great idea, and they deserve a pat on the back for it.
Yep.
Well, probably not. It was just a business decision, really. Fraud was probably costing them more than it would cost to roll out this solution.
But
look, at the same time, they're saying, hey, you know, well, now that we've closed off the phishing, we're bracing for an onset of attacks on malware. It's like, what planet are you guys from? I mean, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, it's not like, oh, Commonwealth Bank's introduced two-factor. Let's you know, redouble our efforts to put malware on computers. They've already been trying to do that. I mean, do you see what I'm saying?
I think this is just another, they've probably got a new person in the marketing department who said, come on, let's come up. We need to be seen to be doing something. And they've come up with this. And it's just, you know, very, very old information that's been repackaged. And yeah, they've put it out there. And yeah, you're right. We should just file it under, you know, releases that would come out from the bleeding obvious department.
Yeah, but, you know, at the same time, good on them. I mean, it's nice to see a bank doing something about it, and they seem to be leading the charge. So
all the banks, they say that, you know, their first biggest form of defence is to educate their customers. And so, you know, this is just going along those lines, really. We'll keep on banging that message, and hopefully one day it'll hit home.
Now, Munir, office, there's been some more office floors, which you know what that means.
Drink!
We've got some more. A trio of what appear to be new, yet-to-be-patched floors in Microsoft Office. Now, yeah, I'm not really totally across these ones, but I mean, you know, why even bother getting across them? They're just, you know, every bloody week we're seeing this.
I was going to say, I mean, I can't keep up. These are new. I mean, does this mean that the previous Word floors and PowerPoint floors, have they actually been patched, or is this another batch on top? I think I'm going to need a scorecard here.
Yeah, now there's one that looks like it could be an exploitable heap overflow, but you know, with the heap protection stuff in Vista, I don't think it's immediately clear what the full extent of this vulnerability is. But it's just a reminder out there that, hey, you know, be careful when handling Word files.
Well, you know, from previous experience here, we'll probably know by Christmas that this is a really, really serious issue.
Yeah. Now, also we've got Microsoft confirming a hack for Vista's OEM product, which means that people can pretty much bypass the registration process. So, drink.
I think this is really interesting because, you know, I mean, we've seen vulnerabilities come up in all sorts of other areas, but when we see vulnerabilities coming up in Windows Genuine Advantage, you know that they're really, really making big problems, because this is something that's going to really, really hurt their revenue. You know, if they can't, the more pirate software is out there, the less money's coming in. We all know that's going to be the main business. That's what they're really, really going for. So, yeah, I think this is a big deal, and I'm sure they'll be running out there to try and fix this as soon as possible.
Yeah, but look, I mean, at the same time, I mean, you're dealing with an operating system here that is installed by default to patch itself automatically.
Yeah.
I mean, Microsoft owns basically every single Vista. I mean, they've got the ultimate Trojan, you know, on every user's computer. It's called the bloody operating system. And they can pretty much push out any update which will render any sort of bypass that they identify fairly useless. So, I mean, in this networked world, you can see why they're not really panicking too hard about someone bypassing their registration feature.
No, not at all. But I'm sure, yeah, they'll get round to it eventually. But, I mean, I think they have got quite a few other things on their plate which they probably should be fixing first.
Now, here's a news item that I picked out just because it's a bit of a trip down memory lane. We've seen a variant of the Storm email worm coming along. And Pastini, we've got advice coming from Pastini.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
that says email users should be on alert for messages with love-related subject lines.
That's a great one, isn't it? It's a great alert to send out there. Beware of subject lines.
Beware of strangers holding bunches of flowers who want to take you to the movies. I mean, it's just...
Well, look, last week we saw websites and emails that were exploiting, you know, still the curse of vulnerability, and I think Paris Hilton and Britney Spears were used in headlines. This is just more social engineering here, and love, it's worked before, so there's no reason why it won't work again.
Well, you and I are actually old enough to remember when Anna Kournikova was the it girl among malware writers.
Oh, yeah.
It's going back a bit, though.
It is a few years, yeah.
Okay, and this is an item that we will be discussing in a little bit more detail with our sponsor, CyberTrust, a bit later on, but looks like CyberCrooks are exploiting, well, direct from the headline, CyberCrooks exploiting new Windows DNS flaw.
Yeah, this could be another serious one, and it could mean, you know, if it is being exploited and it's pretty serious, could it mean the third patch Tuesday in April?
Yeah, well, I guess there's one thing that's kind of a mitigating factor, which is that while it's a DNS flaw, I think the attack vector runs through high ports, you know, through some sort of RPC service, so it's, you know, it's one of those things that is behind a, you know, if you've firewalled your box properly, it shouldn't be a problem. But as we discovered with a couple of those SQL worms like Blaster and Slammer a few years ago, you know, really SQL boxes should be firewalled, but someone wrote up those worms and they still spread like wildfire through VPNs and stuff. So
that's right. I think it's incredible how many firewalls still aren't fully properly configured out there. So although they shouldn't be a problem, I'd put my money on it maybe.
Yeah, well, I'm almost, you know, I know this is a, you know, horrible thing to say for someone who's, you know, on the good side of security, but it's been so long since we've had a decent bloody network worm, you know? don't you hark back to the days? I mean, I was working, you know, I don't know if listeners know this, but I used to work in the field of information security, and it was always so exciting. when something like that would happen, because all of a sudden we'd be picking apart packets and analyzing stuff and, you know, making predictions and seeing which ATMs would stop working and which power grids would fail. It was a pretty exciting time to be in the industry, and it's just sort of got a bit too boring now.
I think it's a really strange thing, but the fact that, you know, organized crime has come in and they're actually only trying to infect, you know, small groups of users so they don't get caught, has actually been helping Microsoft and its PR machine, because they don't get these massive outbreaks anymore. The other thing is because the US government is really coming down so hard, and people that write this kind of stuff, people are probably quite scared out, you know, to put something like that out. So I think both of these two things combined is making our lives a bit less interesting.
Yeah, these cyber crooks are so bloody boring, aren't they? Because, I mean, you pick apart a modern bloody Trojan, and it's full of commented, really neat code with revision control and stuff. I mean, you may as well be looking at a commercial piece of software.
Yeah, we should go back to the bad, dirty old days when they used to just insult the other groups, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, you got owned by Fred, you know. That's, those are the days.
Yeah.
Oh, well, look, Minir, thanks a lot for joining us again this week, and we'll chat next week.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Patrick.
Our thanks again to Minir for joining us this week. So now Ossert's operations manager, Carl Hanmore, joins us, and it looks like, Carl, that there have been some Cisco wireless vulnerabilities.
Yeah, that's right, Pat. It's another fantastic week in the world of vulnerabilities.
Well, we had a couple of quiet ones there, didn't we? And it's all coming back.
Yeah, it's you know, it's only the size of the product that varies, I suppose, the constant stream. So with Cisco, we've got them in a couple of places, and these are a little bit disappointing. You'll find that the Cisco Wireless LAN Controller and the Cisco Lightweight Access Points, a number of different variants of those devices, have some remote compromise features built in. I say features because they're using default configured passwords hard-coded in there.
You're kidding me. I thought it was more of an information disclosure problem, not so much a getting owned. Or is the information being disclosed passwords and things?
One of the elements in there is also the ability to write using SNMP write community strings, not only read. So there's a number of different vols they've disclosed in that one sort of range of products.
A bug involving SNMP? Why am I not surprised? I mean, does anyone actually use that stuff?
Corporates use it all the time. Big corporates, anything that uses this enterprise management stuff, so some of the Tivoli suites or HP OpenView or any number of network-centric management products will use SNMP. And
look, Carl,
I
hate to show myself up as a bit of a geek here, but I've seen some very impressive things done with using MRTG and stuff like that. So I'm just sort of surprised that people haven't got around to ditching SNMP, which is pretty much been proven a few times to be a fairly insecure protocol.
Look, generally people would be advised only to use SNMP read, which allows them to gather data, not actually update the configurations.
Mm.
But out of the box, these things are still turned on, in this case with default values. So, I mean, it's anyone who's vulnerable should be upgrading, but of course, good practice says you should probably check your new hardware for the well-known public and private community strings before actually putting it into your production network. So that was the first sort of area of Cisco Vols. The second is in their wireless control system. So this is a software product used to do that enterprise management sort of thing I was talking about.
Yeah.
And it also is the proud owner of a fixed username password pair that are hard-coded into the product.
Fantastic.
So I suspect, I haven't gone through the details of why Cisco released these, but I suspect they've done a bit of soul searching internally and gone and targeted these sorts of bugs to see too.
So
similar,
I guess,
classes of bugs out at the same time.
I guess we just have to say to Cisco, on behalf of Risky Business, we just have to say to Cisco, good one.
Well, I'm glad to see they've at least got patches out. This is the main thing.
Now, you've mentioned also a bit of a bug in Apache.
Yeah, there's a bug in the Apache SU exec module. This one's not likely to be of a massive concern to the majority of your listeners. However, it's a little bit cute. SU exec's what's used to allow companies to host multiple users and allow
super users
to run as as himself.
God, I mean, look, as soon as you've said there's a bug in Apache, you know, SU exec. I mean, I've never heard of SUEXEC. Sue exec, but I'm thinking super user, execute, Apache, module. That's got to be bad news to begin with, mate.
Well, look, what it means is, let's say you and I are both of the same hosting provider, right?
Yeah.
This module is used to let your CGIs run as you and my CGIs run as me. And
oh, so this isn't like a super user exec thing. This is a separate user exec thing.
Well, yeah, it has to run as the super user.
Okay.
And hence where it becomes a bit interesting. It's not likely to be widely exploited, this one. It really does require an existing account. But in theory, if the planets aligned using this vulnerability, I could, if I've got access to the same hosting provider as you, on the same system, using this module, using a vulnerable version, I could perhaps run, say, Risky Business's website. Might see my photo on the website this afternoon, and if you do, you know I've been playing.
Well, I was going to say, Carl, I mean, it would be quite easy, wouldn't it, to just buy a hosting account with... I mean, look, you know, getting into the mindset of a, you know, former Eastern Bloc country, you know, criminal... not to discriminate, you know, I could buy an account on some, you know, Linux box running, say, 50 different websites of varying popularity. Buy one with a stolen bloody credit card number, get on there, exploit the bug, and then sort of embed malware and stuff on all of those other pages to start deploying them out to unsuspecting users. Yeah. So maybe it's not so trivial.
Well, I mean, the sort of attack you describe, Patrick, is unfortunately pretty par for the course.
Yeah,
we see these things in, you know, volumes of dozens per week.
Yeah,
it is just par for the course. Insecure defaults or bad system configuration.
Yeah,
allows people to compromise sites. And
so I guess it's not really something of too much concern to the enterprise, but definitely will be of concern to organised crime syndicates that can use it to push out all sorts of nasty stuff.
I mean, small to medium enterprise are the people who would possibly be impacted. The people needing to do the work here, they're internet service providers or hosting providers. So most of your members, most of your listeners rather, probably can't do a lot themselves about this because it's unlikely they're running this module, but they should check their Apache configs.
Yeah, well, the vulnerabilities are back. I mean, we saw the lull over Christmas and then, you know, bam, now we've seen a lull over Easter and then bam. So
back with a vengeance. Well, yeah. I mean, I know later on in the show you're going to be talking about Windows DNS vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And that's probably going to be the biggest show in town for the next couple of days.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll be chatting to CyberTrust about that later on. Now, Carl, I understand you're actually at home crook today, so extra special thanks for joining us.
No worries at all.
And get well soon, mate. So we'll speak to you next week.
Cheers. Have a great day.
It's time for this week's feature interview. The last few years have seen an explosion in the deployment of voice over IP solutions. We've also seen a corresponding rise in the rate of organised crime online. One of the latest scams has been named vishing, undoubtedly by some marketing genius out there. Vishing is just like phishing, only unsuspecting users are directed to ring a phone number, not click on a link. It's the same scam in a different bucket. Well, as it turns out, vishing has made insecure VoIP deployments a very attractive target. Where else can you get access to a local number and free calls? We started off by talking to Jason Edelstein, resident voice over IP specialist with Sense of Security, an Australian security consultancy. We started by asking him about attacks that miscreants are performing on voice over IP systems, starting with denial of service attacks.
You can actually do denial of service tests by actually flooding the network with packets aimed at the actual infrastructure or at the handsets themselves, because voice over IP is basically packetized voice. Anything which disrupts the underlying infrastructure will actually affect calls themselves. So if you can basically flood the network as such, it will have an impact on the quality of the calls that are taking place on the network.
You believe that voice systems, when they're secured, can actually be secured more effectively than a traditional POTS system?
With traditional phone systems, the calls aren't encrypted in any way. So if someone is able to actually get access to a MDF-type board and actually plug a phone into that board, they'll be able to actually eavesdrop on the calls.
Yeah.
But with a properly implemented voice over IP system, one that actually uses encryption for both the signaling and the calls themselves, it's much more difficult to eavesdrop on the calls since that they are encrypted.
Yeah, well, I suppose the key words there are a properly deployed system, because it seems that a lot of companies don't really go through the whole rigmarole of securing these things appropriately. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the default out-of-the-box configurations of most of these systems are very much open. The vendors put the systems together with ease of use in mind rather than trying to make them secure.
It sort of sounds like wireless LANs a few years ago, doesn't it?
It's exactly the same sort of stuff. And the thing is, the encryption algorithms and the techniques and the architectures and everything are still developing and maturing over time.
Now, you say that it's quite important to encrypt the signaling traffic, like, you know, SIP traffic and stuff like that. Why is that so important?
Well, I guess the actual SIP is used to actually set up and maintain the call. If you can actually eavesdrop on that particular traffic, you can see the endpoints of the infrastructure. And in some cases, you can actually see usernames and passwords, which are used to authenticate various devices.
That might be useful to someone who's perhaps wanting to piggyback onto the call system and make phone calls overseas at the expense of the company that owns the system.
A lot of the attacks that you can launch against the infrastructure, they do need to be launched locally from within the actual network themselves.
Do you think organisations in Australia have really cottoned on to the fact that these systems do require some attention?
Probably not. Based on the implementations that we've reviewed, I can't think of a single implementation so far that has actually implemented properly both signalling and voice encryption.
Mm.
And very few of them have any controls at the network layer as well.
There's also some horror stories around being able to pick up certain brands of handsets and, you know, just press a few buttons and get valuable network information off the device itself.
Both the Cisco handsets and the Avaya handsets and probably some other networking equipment out there, you can actually hit buttons on them and you can find out key pieces of information like the TFTP servers in the environment, the call gateways, the voice VLANs, the IP address of various components in the network as well.
Now, to stop a lot of these attacks, like I suppose there's the DHCP starvation attacks where you sort of soak up, you can put a box on the network and soak up all of the IPs available from that pool and then get all the handsets to reset so that they can't actually get IPs. I mean, that's one DOS attack.
Yeah,
you've got
one.
ARP spoofing, which is, you know, people can use to intercept calls and, you know, do a man in the middle to listen in or just generally screw around with signaling traffic. To avoid these things, I mean, one of the things that a few people have recommended, including yourself, is to put your voice network on a different VLAN and really lock it down the same way that you would with a normal data network. So have maybe an IPS or an IDS, you know, some sort of monitoring capability on that network to stop people screwing around with ARP, to stop people from screwing around with DHCP. Is that right? Is it really a case that the same sorts of principles apply to securing?
Absolutely. I think the key thing to take away is to think about is that actual voice over IP, it runs over your traditional, your standard data network. So many of the underlying attacks that work against your normal data network will work against voice over IP. So some of those countermeasures that you just spoke about are key things that need to be implemented to stop those types of attacks occurring.
As it turns out, the actual security features in most VoIP systems, is they're actually pretty good, aren't they?
Oh, they're very good. I can comment specifically on the Cisco and Avaya ones because they're the particular implementations I have the most experience with. But they do have some great features in there that can be implemented to stop all these types of attacks that we've spoken about. Avaya, they don't actually make any switching infrastructure, so you would need to buy a switch in that particular implementation that does have these sorts of countermeasures in place. Things like port security. On the Cisco side of things, they've got things called DHCP snooping. There's a whole bunch of ARP. They've got another one called dynamic ARP inspection, which stop a whole bunch of these attacks like the ARP poisoning type attacks.
Can you think of any horror stories, like out-and-out horror stories, where you've been called in where, say, someone's got into a network and they've done a bit of damage?
I can't think of any damage as such, but I do know a couple of organisations that have clocked up very hefty phone bills in the vicinity of sort of $50,000 for a single month.
Wow,
and
that's
someone actually dialing into their phone system and working out a technique for actually taking control of the phone system and forwarding their phone system to other destinations and making calls.
I mean, that's right up there with a teenager using the phone, isn't it? $50,000 in a month. That's a that sounds like a pack of 15-year-olds going nuts.
Either that or something even possibly like organised crime, or even people reselling their particular phone. I mean, you've got these cheap calling cards out there now. The rates that they offer on these calling cards, I don't really see how you could even do it in some cases for that particular price.
So you think there's a little bit of organised crime moving in, even selling phone cards to allow people to access VoIP systems illegally?
It's quite possible.
Okay, and the other scam that's actually becoming quite popular, now I got this from a law enforcement guy who told me that he'd remove my tongue if I named him, so so I won't. But he says that vishing scams, you know, which are the phishing scams where people are encouraged to dial a phone number rather than click on a link in an email, you know, they're making VoIP boxes actual attractive targets for scammers in that, you know, they get to hijack a local number and they look like they've got a little bit of legitimacy because they've got a local phone number. Is that something that you've seen?
It's not something that I can sort of comment on specifically. I don't see any reason why people couldn't do that. The only thing is, though, if you are hijacking someone's number, you are going to be forwarding it to another destination. So obviously, if someone does manage to find out that sort of scam is taking place and look at the phone configuration, they'd be able to see where the end point is that it's being forwarded to, unless you put it through a whole loop of various systems.
It just seems that voice systems, whereas before, I mean, okay, great to go and make a few cheap calls, it's looking like now they are actually a bit of a legitimate target.
Yeah.
All right, Jason. Well, look, thank you very much. I understand you're very busy, so thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was security consultant Jason Edelstein, who works for Sense of Security. Next, we'll hear from Colin Bradley. He works as a security business development manager for Cisco in Sydney. He acknowledges that VoIP systems are a target, but says you're no worse off using VoIP than you are with traditional copper-lined phones, as long as you make the most of the security features that ship with your kit.
In certain aspects, there are potential for greater security problems. In other areas, there is a potential for less issues as well, fewer issues. I think the whole problem with the security environment is that it is such a large elephant that, you know, you're always constantly striving to decide which part of the elephant you're going to try and actually digest next.
I guess, you know, we've seen instances where you've got a lot of traffic sort of flying around networks that's pretty easy to intercept. I mean, I know that people are trying to combat this, but at the end of the day, you've got to be able to configure this stuff properly in order for it to be secure, and people don't seem to be doing that.
The first thing where I think that things are still challenged today is that because of where TDM technology's got to, most of us are used to expecting dial tone every time we pick up the phone.
So you mean time division multiplexing?
Yes. So you know, traditional PBX environments, we expect to actually have 5 nines availability on voice solutions. The challenge that we actually have once you start to translate that through onto a converged infrastructure is that it's not always been the case that people have expected 5 nines availability on their data infrastructure that you're now going to overlay voice onto. And so my first concern when I talk to people about things is that voice is probably the most critical asset that anybody will consider that is necessary to keep running at all costs today. And therefore, when you are going to put voice over IP onto a converged infrastructure, the first thing you should be making sure is that the infrastructure you're going to put it on, by its own very nature, is inherently secure. There are facilities that we have built into our core infrastructure products that are there to actually help. Different people have got a requirement for different models because everyone's attitude to security is different. And therefore, in certain aspects, you know, it is very, very subjective as to what is secure for one person is not necessarily secure for somebody else.
Sure. Now, let's look at, I suppose, some of the drawbacks here. And from what I understand, through various things like ARP spoofing and whatever, you know, it's actually quite easy to intercept traffic and listen to calls. Basically, once you're on that network, it's quite easy to sort of have a poke around and listen to it. I mean, is that a statement you agree with?
Well, again, like, there is a slide that we put up that sort of says these are the tools that you used to need in the TDM environment. These are the tools that you need today to do the same thing in the IP-based environment. So, you know, yeah, there are tools that people can get hold of, and if they want to listen into calls, it is possible to do it. The same way that there is an Australian company recently who demonstrated a clamp that you can put onto a fiber optic link and actually watch everything that goes up and down a fiber.
I believe a lot of Cisco kit actually comes with encryption-capable handsets, doesn't it?
Well, that's where it comes. You know, there are options that people have got there to enable if and when they feel that it's appropriate, because sometimes the complexity of the implementations actually outweigh the benefits that are going to come from a risk reduction perspective.
There are those options to secure, you know, VoIP systems, but generally people just don't bother with them, do they? Because they're too much hassle.
Well, I can't say that, you know, there are a lot of things that people don't bother with that they should do. Cisco's view on that is, well, isn't it about time you started to implement your infrastructure in that way to provide you with that level of protection? And this is the whole part that we can only actually make people aware that, you know, there are features, as I said, that's built into the core switching and routing products. There are features built into the unified communication product. And then there are the standalone security solutions around firewalling and IPS that you should actually use a combination of each of those elements to produce what we'd consider to be a truly secure voice environment.
And of course, you know, you can deploy anti sort of spoofing measures, which would make the interception of packets over a network, you know, easily detectable.
The challenge that there is whether people want to actually invest in those things And if they do, invest in them, whether they then actually turn them on and use them in the way that is most beneficial to their organisation.
But the, I guess what I'm seeing, you know, and hearing about is that people generally are screwing things up in the integration phase. It's not the procurement phase that, you know, that they're getting wrong. They're buying the right kit. They're just not quite using it properly.
Well, again, you know, we have a view, and we've released a number of new initiatives within Cisco to actually talk. We don't talk about wireless anymore. We talk about secure wireless. We don't talk about unified communications anymore. It's talking about secure unified communications. And it's trying to actually make people understand that security has to be an element of these implementations and a consideration each time you do it. The challenge that there then is actually making sure that security is by its very nature a core skill in every systems engineer, in every deployment engineer.
Don't you think that's expecting a little much?
Today, yes. Do I think that it's things that needs to change over the next 2 to 3 years? Definitely. And, you know, I am already working with Cisco's integration partners to try and help them understand that, you know, as the fight gets taken out to new areas from an information security perspective, certain core skills have to be exhibited by every engineer. So especially in the whole area of firewalling, intrusion prevention technology, and the correct use of encryption is something that's going to have to be a base skill for every engineer from a unified communications perspective.
You're listening to Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with me, Patrick Gray. This program is sponsored by CyberTrust and hosted by Vigabyte. Now, the fine folks at CyberTrust pay our bills, so each week we like to have one of their experts on the show to digest an issue of the week. This week it's those pesky Windows DNS flaws. As listeners may be aware, it's not actually possible to attack a Microsoft DNS server if it's firewalled correctly, even if the DNS port is available. This is a small piece of information many reports have simply just left out. The bug that we're talking about is exploited by attacking the servers through RPC-related ports, so don't panic. If you're operating a DNS server that's exposed to the internet, you're fine, as long as your RPC-related services are blocked, which they should be anyway. There is, however, still potential for this thing to become a worm, and a serious one at that. We saw that with SQL worms a few years ago, Slammer and Blaster. SQL ports, like RPC ports, have no worldly business being available over the internet, but that didn't stop those worms wriggling their way through VPNs and making a hideous mess out of corporate networks. So now we're going to have a chat to Brian Dennehy, who works for CyberTrust, about best practice in firewalling. Brian, this vulnerability, although it's not, you know, a disastrous and critical vulnerability, does raise some interesting questions around best practice, doesn't it?
Yes, Patrick, it does. In general, we recommend that people only have as many ports open as they absolutely have to have in order to avoid collateral damage, so to speak. The DNS problem relies on having RPC ports open inbound, and there's also been a report that it can propagate on port 445, which is notorious already for not being something you want to let in from the internet to a private network.
What's on 445 normally?
Active Directory.
Oh, okay, yeah, right.
So there's ample reason already for not having 445 open, but having 2,000 or 3,000 DCE RPC ports as well is really just asking for trouble, because even if the DNS vulnerability is not being targeted, then there are plenty more which are on those sorts of ports.
Yeah, I guess this raises questions for me around best practice, because, I mean, we saw those SQL worms that ripped through the internet a few years ago, and everyone thought, hey, SQL, who leaves SQL open to the internet? You know, this is not going to be a problem. And of course, you know, being a worm, it sort of wormed its way into VPNs, it wormed its way into corporate networks. And the next thing you know, power plants were failing and ATMs stopped working. So even though these are ports that you would, you know, most organizations would not allow to be accessed from the internet, there is a real risk there anyway, because these worms always find a way of bridging themselves into restricted networks, don't they?
They certainly try hard.
Yeah.
We see over 1 million hits a day from the old SQL Slammer.
Is that across your sensor network, is it?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a lot. I remember even a couple of years ago, Code Red was still floating about. I'm sure it is somewhere. So I guess it really brings home that message of defense in depth, doesn't it? I mean, even if, you know, you're invulnerable, you think you're invulnerable for attack from outside the organization, chances are if it gets onto an internal network, it could still cause you some damage.
Yeah, particularly if you've got something like VPNs allowing multiple ports in as well.
So do you think this is a case where people really need to start locking down their VPN policies? I mean, people have been saying this for years, but is this making it all the more important?
I think it certainly raises the profile yet again. It's something that most people really should have done a long time ago, but that's not what we find.
Mm-hmm. So would you imagine that there are some miscreants out there working up a network worm? I had a bit of a joke with Munir Katadia, who we interviewed at the head of the program, saying, you know, it'd be kind of almost, you'd get a feeling of nostalgia seeing a network worm come along these days, you know, sort of be make it fun again.
Well, let's say there's already been plenty of public exploit code being released. The question is it profitable to let a worm loose these days?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be, does it?
No, well, you know, you aim to keep the network up and running, but take over some small number of boxes rather than taking everything down and causing you to fix it rather than just play at fixing it.
Well, I suppose, Brian, I'd ask, what's the message now to CyberTrust clients? Is it really reinforcing that message of, hey, you know, look after your internal network, don't go for the hard perimeter soft center model, or are you advising people just in this specific instance to really go through and block those RPC ports?
Well, if they're already following our best practice, they locked down those ports a long time ago. So in general, we're not too concerned. But for the rest of the world, then maybe you should be starting to worry.
Yes, okay. Well, Brian, thank you very much for speaking to Risky Business.
Good to talk to you again, Patrick.
That was CyberTrust's Brian Dennehy. Well, that's it for Risky Business this week. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Thanks again to our sponsor, CyberTrust, and our hosting partner, Vigabyte. Me and the gang will be back next week with more news and analysis. So thanks for listening.